Possible raids from Immigration and Customs Enforcement this weekend targeting undocumented families for deportation. Just the idea of raids by ICE is scary for kids in immigrant communities.
ICE will park a couple blocks from here, and the kids will know because they will get off the bus and they will walk to school petrified because they saw ICE when they were getting off the bus.
Teacher Norma Garces calms her students while dealing with her own family's concerns. Also, air travel is a big contributor to greenhouse gases, so France is putting an eco-tax on airline tickets.
In some ways, this is a bit of a drop in the ocean. It won't do much to deter flying, but we do think it's an important step by the French government.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories plus an update on tanker skirmishes in the Persian Gulf, all coming up today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. If you are undocumented or know someone who is, the sight of a van driving through your neighborhood with the Immigration and Customs Enforcement logo on the side can give you a jolt. Students at El Colegio High School in South Minneapolis know that feeling. Their public charter school also serves as a community center. Every day it bustles with events, meetings, dance classes, or driver's ed sessions. Almost all of the students at the school are Latino or of indigenous descent, and many have parents, grandparents, or aunts and uncles who are undocumented. Those students woke up to the news this morning that the Trump administration is once again planning raids across the country to arrest thousands of undocumented immigrants. Minneapolis is not among the 10 key cities the raids are targeting. Still, Norma Garces, the school's executive director, says her students are scared.
There's a lot of fear in the community and concern and the unknown. So we have meetings where we prepare the families to what could happen. We bring lawyers so they don't get fraud, but they hear from the right sources about how to be prepared, what they need, real tangible things that are going to help them to be prepared for anything.
In the past, when these headlines have popped up, possible raids, I mean, what kind of advice do you give your students? Do you give to staff?
We have a form, like a checklist. They put all their documents ready in a box so that the kids know, like, there's where the passports are. This is where your birth certificates are. This is your vaccinations. This is your bank accounts. This is who's responsible for the bank accounts, because I'm a high school. So a lot of the kids might be responsible for their siblings if their parents would be picked up.
So if the parents were picked up, then the kids are suddenly, I mean, they have the materials they need. But boy, that's really tough because they're still kids, right? And suddenly they're thrust into adulthood. Yep. How do you get them ready for that?
They have to talk about it. I have family members that are not documented, and I talk about it with my students. And everybody knows somebody who doesn't have documents, who is a very important part in our community and is a vital person for somebody. So we have to talk about it.
Have you ever been concerned that there might be a possibility that the El Colegio school itself would be raided?
ICE will park a couple blocks from here, and the kids will know because they will get off the bus and they will walk to school petrified because they saw ICE when they were getting off the bus. When we talked to the politicians, they said that they were looking for someone, so that's why they stopped right there, for a parent, I guess. But the schools that were nearby will call each other and will let each other know where ICE was. But what we had to do with the students was that if ICE was nearby, we blow a whistle in the playground and the kids will come in, no questions asked. And it happened twice.
Wow.
But we had to do that.
Is that still a concern?
They can come into a school and arrest a student because they're over 18. So we don't know if they will show up.
I mean, that's got to be really tough for the kids to see, you know, ICE patrol cars on their way to school. When you brought those immigration attorneys to the school to talk to students about their rights, how did that go? What kind of questions did the students ask?
They're very concerned for their parents. They're very concerned for their aunts and uncles who don't have documents. They might have an older brother that is not documented, and everybody else is citizen. So everybody has somebody. So they were asking a lot of questions about that. What if they go back? What if you have a green card? Will you be deported? What if you get detained as a citizen? They're very concerned that they will get confused. How would they prove that they're citizens?
And what about your staff, Norma? I mean, they're the ones who have to comfort the kids. How are they feeling?
Well, we have to be there for the kids, right? And if they were working in a bigger school where they don't talk about it, when they know the kids are in fear, that maybe just one teacher, but they cannot talk to their principal about it, or the principal is like, that's not our business and we should not be asking the kids about these things, don't create more gossip or whatever. Like in the big schools, it will be diminished In here, we're all helping each other. My staff knows what to say. Everybody knows the lawyers are part of our community. We are in a community that we're safe. We have created that more intentionally in the last 2 years.
These raid announcements, the White House announced one a few weeks ago, and then President Trump met some resistance and said they'd be postponed. Do the on-again, off-again announcements impact students at your school?
Of course. You could see, like, the anxiety on the kids. You can see the, you know, everybody on their phone texting their parents, like I'm okay, but ICE is in the corner. All we needed was one person to put ICE is 2 blocks from El Colegio. So if I'm a parent of El Colegio, I'm going to be worried.
Do you have a particular story about a student who is worried about all of this, maybe even worried about deportation or being separated from their family?
I mean, I only have a green card, and my son, who's a U.S. citizen, worries about it and gets anxiety about it. Like, Mom, would they take you? And because of the job that you do, will they come in? And I will be the one dealing with ICE outside, so would I be arrested because I'm resistant to take one of my students? So he worries about that.
What do you tell him?
That I'll be okay. That we have a lot of community that will back us up and that will not let me, you know, take away. But if they take me away, in 24 hours, I'll be in Mexico probably, and he'll join me.
In your heart of hearts, do you believe that you will be okay?
In my heart of hearts, I think it might be a bigger deal. Because I'm a principal and I'm putting everything on the line.
Norma, we're thinking about you and all your students there at the El Colegio High School in Minneapolis.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Norma Garces heads El Colegio High School in South Minneapolis, Minnesota. There was a fresh military standoff in the Persian Gulf today. This one involved Iranian gunboats and a British warship escorting an oil tanker. The Iranians attempted to block the passage of the tanker, but backed off when confronted by the Royal Navy frigate. Iran had threatened to retaliate against the UK after British Marines seized an Iranian tanker off Gibraltar last week. That tanker was allegedly smuggling oil to Syria. Of course, the bigger context is the U.S. campaign of maximum pressure against Iran. The Gulf is a source of 20% of the world's oil, and growing tensions with Iran could endanger that. Ellen Wald is an energy consultant and the author of Saudi Inc., The Arabian Kingdom's Pursuit of Profit and Power. How unusual is this kind of standoff?
It's not unheard of, and it has happened in the past. There was an incident in 2015 where Iran tried to seize a ship that was carrying certain cargo or certain containers that it had disputed. And then as a result of this, the U.S. Navy was escorting some tankers through this area. So it's not unheard of. The question is really, how long is this going to go on? And what kind of effect is this going to have in the long term on traffic going through the straits? Because in the previous issue, the military escorts only lasted about a week. But if this goes on, it could cause some congestion in the area. And the other issue is the expense of having these military vessels escorting the oil tankers.
There was a tanker war in the Gulf in the 1980s. What is the 30-second history of that, and how disruptive was that to the world's oil markets?
Well, it was definitely disruptive to the world's oil markets, but it really occurred against the backdrop of a much larger war between Iran and Iraq. And that's not really a situation that we're seeing here. I don't see a whole lot of parallels in this case, other than the fact that the U.S. Navy was needed to ensure the security of tankers. The world oil market is in a different situation these days than it was in the 1980s, but I can see why people are looking to that for parallels, though the political, diplomatic, and military situation is not really the same at all.
Is the energy market nervous about the possibility of a confrontation in the Gulf?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, and it seems that the energy market is really not all that reactive to this situation. In any other situation, we might see just news that Iranian ships even threatened an oil tanker would cause prices to jump. But right now, the energy market is really very fixated on slowing demand for oil. And that's really keeping a lid on prices right now. The only thing that's really affecting prices right now we see is demand, is the overall economic situation. So when we get news that the U.S. and China might resolve their trade dispute, that can cause oil to go up. But these issues in the Gulf are really not affecting oil nearly as much as we would expect in a different demand situation.
Ellen Wald, energy consultant and the author of Saudi Inc. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, we will be landing shortly. To ensure your safety.
Here's a fun fact to think about if you're going to hop on a plane this summer.
Dollar for dollar, hour for hour, there's nothing else you can do or spend your money on which has a worse impact on the climate than flying.
We'll be hearing more from that guy in a second. The airline industry is trying to tackle this climate problem, and now France is doubling down. Officials this week announced a new tax on flights as part of the French government effort to fight climate change. Here's the world's Carolyn Beeler.
France's Transport Minister Elisabeth Borne announced the per-ticket tax on all flights originating in France. When it goes into effect next year, the tax is expected to raise about $200 million a year for improvements to greener transport options, things like local rail.
Elle sera progressive et représentera une contribution de 1,50 € par billet.
Borne says the tax will start at about $1.50 for economy flights within the EU and go up to $20 for business class tickets on flights leaving Europe. Not a whole lot.
It's an exceptionally low rate. In some ways, this is a bit of a drop in the ocean.
Andrew Murphy is with the Brussels-based nonprofit Transport and Environment.
It won't do much to deter flying, but we do think it's an important step by the French government. And if it's a part of a package which increases this tax over time, which starts mandating clean fuels, which starts investing in alternative means of transport, we think it can make ultimately a contribution.
Aviation is currently responsible for about 5% of the pollution that's warming our atmosphere. And in Europe, flights have increased a whopping 26% in the last 5 years.
And that makes it the fastest growing source of emissions in Europe. What we say here is that aviation is Europe's biggest climate failure.
Europe has started to make strides in reducing emissions from ground transport and buildings.
We're starting to see some small declines, but aviation emissions are continuing to grow rapidly.
Murphy says as more people realize that, public attitudes about flying, and to a small extent attitudes within the industry itself, are starting to change. Take Sweden's recent flight-shaming movement, for example, or this recent ad from the Dutch airline KLM.
We all have to fly every now and then.
It actually encourages us to fly less.
Do you always have to meet face-to-face? Could you take the train instead? Could you contribute by compensating your CO2 emissions or packing light?
When France's green flight tax goes into effect next year, it'll join similar taxes in Norway and Sweden. Aviation economist Jasper Farber says this new tax won't reduce the number of flights taken from France. It'll just slow down the increase in passenger numbers just a little bit.
Based on previous research, this French aviation tax will reduce demand by about 1% relative to the baseline of 5% growth per year.
But Farber argues there's a better way to tackle this problem. Unlike in the U.S., most airplane fuel in Europe is not taxed. And Farber says changing that would have a more direct impact on carbon emissions than a per-ticket tax.
It would have a bigger impact for several reasons. First of all, because it rewards airlines that invest in more efficient aircraft, and it reduces demand at the same time.
France is considering taxing jet fuel. So are the Netherlands and Sweden. Farber says it'd be even better if these countries also added an incentive to get airlines to switch to expensive, lower-carbon biofuels. Until that happens, the best option for cutting your carbon footprint while flying is just like that ad said, fly a little less. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Just ahead, another French tax was passed today with big consequences for U.S. tech firms. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. It's The World. The U.S. is pushing back on a new tax law in France that's aimed at big tech firms, the usual suspects, including Apple, Facebook, and Google. The 3% tax is on sales generated in France by those companies. President Trump has ordered an investigation which could result in retaliatory tariffs. French Finance Minister Bruno Le Maire defended the new tax today, saying France was, quote, sovereign, and decided its own tax rules. Dave Lee is with our BBC partners. He's their Silicon Valley reporter and joins us from San Francisco. How much is this tax, and will it only affect U.S. tech companies?
It won't only affect U.S. tech companies, Marco, but the majority of the companies that are wrapped up in this new tax will be U.S. firms, because this is a tax that's going to be on internet companies that do business in France but don't necessarily have a physical presence there. So, for example, companies like Facebook, what this tax will seek to do is tax 3% on internet companies that have global annual revenues of more than 750 million euros. That's around $850 million. And the French finance minister, he predicted that that's going to bring in around 400 million euros to France every single year.
What is the goal of this tech tax? I mean, why is France doing this?
Well, France sees this as something of a leveling of the playing field. It's going to be a tax on revenue rather than profit, because, of course, one of the things that has been particularly frustrating to many governments around the world for some time now is the ability for technology companies to operate in countries where they have no real substantial presence, which is something that, you know, in times gone by, companies simply weren't able to do. But with the dawn of the internet and social media and so forth, that has become possible. But that's something Silicon Valley certainly isn't keen on, because globally that will open them up to a lot more chances to be taxed in the countries where they're popular.
Without France explicitly articulating it, do you believe that this tax might be a form of punishment for many of these Silicon Valley companies not getting in order the disinformation on their social media platforms?
I mean, it certainly helps when it comes to expressing these policies, both to colleagues in political circles in places like France, but also the electorate as well. I mean, one of the reasons why the US has said this targets American companies is because politicians have explicitly mentioned American companies when they've been formulating these tax plans. You know, often we hear in sound bites, politicians refer to this kind of thing as an Amazon tax or an Apple tax. There was a recent incident with the leader of the opposition in the UK when Amazon celebrated its 25th anniversary recently, the opposition leader sent a card to them saying many happy tax returns as a as a political stunt, a PR stunt. So it's a vote winner, put it that way. Tighter regulations on tech companies is certainly something that all political shades seem to be on board with.
The big reaction today has been from Washington. The Trump administration announced a formal investigation into whether the tax unfairly discriminates against U.S. businesses. What would the U.S. do in retaliation if the investigation concludes that there is discrimination?
Yes, well, this is the big question here. What exactly could this lead to? Now, it could be looking at adding tariffs on things that France is especially active with exporting to the US. So, for example, commercial aviation, wine and so forth, France exports a lot of that. So that could be one direction the US may take. Although, having said that, we do know that the French Finance Ministry and the US Treasury are in contact with each other. And there is an increasing feeling, I think, that this is a play by France to kind of force the issue. I think there is this desire, not just from France, but from several countries, to say what we need to do is not have this piecemeal tax situation in different countries around the world, but to have one tax regime for everyone that means companies can't pick and choose the countries that give them favorable conditions to store their money. Ultimately, that does seem more likely, an agreement rather than major tariffs that could affect France.
BBC Silicon Valley reporter Dave Lee joining us from San Francisco. Thank you, Dave.
Thanks, Marco.
Amsterdam's Rijksmuseum is beginning the biggest ever restoration of a famous painting by Rembrandt, The Night Watch. The masterpiece was created in 1642, and it is a massive canvas, 700 pounds, more than 12 feet tall and 15 feet wide. This restoration is going to literally be a sight to behold. The painting will still be on display inside a massive glass chamber where the restoration work will be on public view. The BBC's Anna Holligan paid a visit.
Men in yellow vests are climbing ladders and polishing the glass to ensure this platform, this vast glass chamber, is ready.
I just want to know how it was made.
Taco Dibbets, director of the Rijksmuseum.
I think there is such a mystery around it because it's such an ambitious, huge painting, a complex composition, that I just want to know how did he do it? I hope we will get more insight in that.
While the crew continue to construct, let me tell you more about the Night Watch. Rembrandt broke convention, filling his canvas with movement and action.
Of course, paintings are silent, But when you look at it, you hear a huge cacophony of noises going on, just as there's going on now.
We said we were in a museum. We are in a museum. It doesn't sound like it because there is this huge box being built all around us here. What exactly is going on?
We saw some changes in the surface of the painting, so we decided to find out what exactly is happening to it and how we can best treat it for the future. So what we're running now is nearly a military operation in the public eye.
Back in 1642, this painting wasn't called The Night Watch, and it's not even set at night. Its modern title comes from the painting's varnish, which darkened over the years, dimming the original colour. They're streaming the restoration online in an effort to shed light on the process. And this first stage is all about analysing the paint structure, science and chemistry.
Yeah. My name is Katrien Keune, and indeed I'm trained as a chemist. I'm the head of the science department in the Rijksmuseum. We start with a scanner, what is specially developed for investigating paintings. What paint Rembrandt used and where he used it. The highest advanced camera attached to this frame. Daylight and UV images 20 times thinner than your hair. That is such high resolution and will fly over the painting and making images. These are all ingredients we need to take into account to get an idea about the current condition of the night watch.
With that added public scrutiny here in the museum, but also all over the world, how are you feeling about this? Pressure?
It's our profession, so we're trained to.
This is just the start of a process that will take years. Actually, having it in public view, in a sense, takes the pressure off because there's no rush to get it exactly back into the gallery.
Exactly, I think that is really the benefit of having it in the gallery.
2019 marks the 350th anniversary of Rembrandt's death. His magnificent masterpiece remains a magnet. And Operation Night Watch hopes to guarantee this precious part of his legacy lives on.
And the restoration will be streamed live, so we don't have to fly there. The BBC's Anna Holligan reporting from the Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam. You're listening to The World. Nigeria outlawed slavery 100 years ago, but the fallout continues.
The mere fact that someone's great-great-great-great-great-grandfather was owned by somebody else put so many stumbling blocks in their way. That, for me, was the part that I just found so horrifying.
I'm Marco Werman. Nigerian writer Adobe Trisha Wobani and the legacy of slavery coming up on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. When we talk about Syrian refugees who fled the civil war at home, we're often telling stories of hardship and loss. But there are also stories of perseverance. Here's one now about a Syrian couple who found refuge in Turkey and built a small business in their kitchen. The couple is serving up home-cooked meals to hungry Istanbul residents. They're offering classic Syrian dishes with a little help from the messaging service WhatsApp. Duri Buskaran explains.
Every morning, the smartphones of more than 100 Istanbul residents light up with a cheery Arabic greeting and a menu. The message is paired with pictures of home-cooked dishes, freshly prepared by Samar Almola every morning in her kitchen in central Istanbul. As Samar cooks, she checks her phone as customers order meals for pickup and delivery. At the kitchen table, her husband Yusuf chops parsley for tabbouleh. Samar takes toasted dumplings out of the oven and stirs them into a yogurt sauce for shish barak. On another burner, she fries up kibbeh, spiced, fragrant ground meat in a tasty bulgur casing. Samar and Yusuf named their business Mutbakh Karadish. Mutbakh meaning kitchen and Karadish. That's Fatma Injaru. She's Syrian too, and she's translating our conversation.
That is really the difficult, because Karadish in Syrian, it's like hard to translate it, oh my God.
After a brief back and forth, we decide.
Yeah, Karadish, It's like really the very big pieces of meat with bones. But also we use it if we are a little bit fat. So we say, oh my God, I have a lot of karadish.
احنا اسد من الاسد من كراديش هذا الاسم الوفره بالطعام.
It's a metaphor actually. They used the name just to notify that they are really generous in the food. The food is really rich.
Life wasn't always like this. When the war in Syria started, Yusuf worked as an engineer in Damascus. Samar stayed home, raising their four kids. Sure, her kibbeh was the best in town, but she never thought she'd earn a living with it. But then the war came home.
My husband was arrested for a month and a half in Syria. Therefore, we had to take the decision to flee.
Samar and Yusuf were lucky. They got on a plane, flew to Istanbul, and were safe. But work was hard to come by. Just a fraction of the millions of Syrians who live in Turkey have been granted work permits. And Turkish employers want Turkish speakers. Unemployment rates are high for both Syrians and Turks. Samar and Yusuf sank their savings into a couple of business ventures that didn't work out, Yusuf says.
بعدين طلعت ببالنا انه وخلص ما عاد عنا احنا مبلغ يعني كان عنا خميره من المال.
So, and then we were out of money. Then we thought about an idea to start with, but with no cost, almost no cost.
One day, their adult daughter mentioned how bad the cafeteria food was at her office. So Samar sent her in with lunch to share with her coworkers, and they said they loved it.
That their food really tastes the same like their mother's food.
That praise meant the world to Samar.
That answer, that feedback actually gave her or always gives her the power to overcome all the difficulties.
Soon, word started to spread. Samar and Yusuf were invited onto a cooking show, profiled on an Arabic language YouTube channel and a local culinary website. The WhatsApp group swelled, and most of their customers in Istanbul had one thing in common. They were all living far from home.
Syrians, Iraqis, Algerians, Somalis, Yemenis.
To keep up with demand, Samar had to cap the group at 150 people. But the message was clear. In Istanbul, there is a market for homemade food, though maybe not for the same reasons that Blue Apron and Grubhub took off in the States.
They feel that they are feeding their children.
Istanbul has one of the largest refugee populations in the world, a significant number of international workers and students, and young Turks who are increasingly moving away from their extended families to live in the city. That means a good chunk of Istanbul residents are far from home.
It's a very strong feeling that they want to serve those youngs who are far from their families. They feel very satisfied when they feel that they could make them happy even from a meal.
We sent a message to Samar's WhatsApp group to ask her customers what her food means to them.
الميمة سمر يعني أمنا الشامية اللي موجودة بقلب اسطنبول.
And they responded in English and Arabic.
I am in love with this family, this beautiful family.
يعني كثير مبسوطين نحن منهم و
تعامل كثير. I love you, Samar, and thank you very much for you.
لأنه من بعد الأم حفيروطن.
I mean, who wouldn't love to have a homemade Syrian dish like our moms used to make?
Samar and Yusuf are now finishing up a small business training program. At the end, they'll compete for a small grant to expand their business into a commercial kitchen. In the meantime, Samar started a new WhatsApp group to help other Syrian women start kitchens of their own. For the world, Duri Buscarin, Istanbul.
Now to another part of the immigration debate that sparked a lot of discussion lately, I'm talking about the language Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has used to describe migrant detention centers at the U.S.-Mexico border.
The United States is running concentration camps on our southern border.
That's brought up the question, is it appropriate to use language from the Holocaust to describe the crisis at the border? Some Jewish activists think so. They're now saying never again to protest the detention of migrants. And a growing list of Latinx Jewish people have been signing an open letter that calls for the camps at the southern border to close. Erica Tykes Blandon is one of the people who signed. She's a student at Harvard Law School and the child of Central American migrants from Nicaragua and Holocaust survivors from Druya in modern-day Belarus.
I personally am not strongly focused on calling the detention centers concentration camps, but I understand and I strongly support the strategy behind that. I'm on the board for the Central American Student Association across all the Harvard schools. And one of the conversations we had the other day was how it's frustrating to see people talk about the crisis like it's a new crisis. And my concern is that once a Democrat is back in office at some point in the future, the detention center conditions will be slightly improved. And everyone will say, well, they're no longer this extreme image of a concentration camp in my mind, so it's all good. And I want to push people to see the detention centers by themselves, that term alone, are horrifying, period, and that they're so worthy of your disgust and your sadness and your anger in their own right, and they always have been. But that said, I understand why the term is getting used.
I mean, it sounds, I got to say, Erica, like you've been considering your Jewish identity and what's at stake when you make these comparisons. Like, you've been thinking about it a lot.
Definitely. You know, I saw comments by a Jewish person the other day saying that protesting the border situation is the most Jewish thing that they've ever done in recent years. And I mean, I would tell that person, you know, just wait and see how Jewish you can feel when you protest this very same, if not similar or worse, policies happening all over the place, including in Israel, which for me has always been a really big call to my Judaism.
I'm a little surprised to hear your attention is drawn to the situation between Israelis and Palestinians, comparing it to the situation along the southern border. I mean, that's a territorial dispute. It's not people coming over the border seeking safety and freedom, right?
I would say that I'm not the only one who's drawn this connection between Palestine and the U.S.-Mexico border. The apartheid wall company that made Gaza into a 139-square-mile open-air prison, Magal Security Systems, is the same company that submitted a bid to build Trump's wall here. Trump himself has said to look at Israel's wall when he defends the creation of a wall here. You know, even putting aside the U.S.-Mexico border for a moment, I don't think you can talk about the Holocaust in remembrance today without talking about Palestine.
Yeah, and do you think there's additional harm in making those comparisons because perhaps one group's tragedy almost diminishes the other group's?
I don't understand how it would diminish it. I think that coming together like this makes us stronger. I think that, you know, when we talk about family separation and we talk about caging people, and if we acknowledge that that's horrible, we have to acknowledge that that's horrible in every single instance that it happens.
Let's leave the border out of this. Generally, do you feel like you've got two identities, and are they clashing right now, or are they almost complementary?
I think that it has taken me a while to get to this point where they feel very complementary. When I was growing up, I was raised in an extremely Jewish environment. Even though there were not a lot of Jewish people where I was raised, we didn't even have a temple. We had like a church that we put like a blanket over the little baby Jesus and the cross and like rented out that space a couple times a week. And it wasn't until I left the home and went to college that I got a lot more involved with my Latinidad. Today, I have a happy middle ground, I guess, where, I don't know, I do what I do. And I believe that what I do is rooted in both my Latinidad, my Central American background, and in my Jewish background. And a lot of people would disagree with me in terms of what I think Judaism promotes and what I think is quote-unquote Jewish, but that's okay. It's just sort of, it's my interpretation, it's my understanding of what it means.
Erica Tykes Blandon is Latina, Jewish, and a student at Harvard Law School. Erica, thanks very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
This evening in Washington, President Trump stepped out to the Rose Garden at the White House and made an announcement related to his push to add a citizenship question to the 2020 census. You'll recall the Supreme Court blocked that move last month. The World's Monica Campbell joins me now. Monica, what did President Trump say and what struck you about his comments?
Well, he said he's not backing down from his quest to collect citizenship data from every person in the United States. And, you know, we heard him frame the question as very simple and that it shouldn't be controversial. Why is it difficult for somebody to say whether they're a citizen or not? He said, oh, gee. As if that is a question that anybody should be willing to answer. And what that doesn't grasp is how critical it is for a true census count that everybody be counted, whether they are not, whether they're a citizen or not, in order to gain full representation. And not everybody wants to offer that type of information in a census.
Well, here's Trump speaking earlier.
I am hereby ordering every department and agency in the federal government to provide the Department of Commerce with all requested records regarding the number of citizens and non-citizens in our country. They must furnish all legally accessible records in their possession immediately.
Right. So that's his executive order to seek all this information through other sources. Trump blamed far left Democrats who fought him on this question, even though it was the Supreme Court that rejected the citizenship question last month. Remind us again, Monica, why did the Supreme Court rule against this plan?
Well, the administration argued that the citizenship question was needed to protect the voting rights of racial minorities. And the Supreme Court said that that wasn't reason enough, that it was contrived. And on the left, we heard that this was clearly a political question, that this was a question to cater to Republicans and Trump's base to try and divide the country between citizens and non-citizens. So that was the main argument from the left.
Obviously, this remains very important for President Trump and the White House. Why is the administration determined to do this?
It's a very powerful move. It could change how many people respond to the census. And some surveys are already finding that millions of people would stay away from the census if the citizen question was included. And if that's the case, that would change the count. And it would change federal funding for things like roads and schools. And very importantly, the number of congressional seats for certain parts of the country. I mean, ultimately, it would change how our democracy works.
Trump and the White House are going to try and get the information one way or the other, they say. So what is the main concern for immigrant communities when it comes to a citizenship question on the census or any of this information?
Well, one concern is that this could lead to fewer, if this question were to be included in the census, that it could lead to fewer resources in immigrant communities that are already generally undercounted in the census and under-resourced nationally. So it could gut voting power as well in heavily immigrant parts of the U.S. And already there's worries that all of this news is sowing confusion and that people will consider this census toxic, that it's going to be something to stay away from. We'll see how that plays out in reality. There's going to be a large grassroots campaign to make sure people fill out the census. But we'll see how that plays out, because this news has been very confusing. It's fear-mongering. And we'll see in the end how the count really goes.
The World's Monica Campbell, thanks very much for your time.
You're very welcome.
In Nigeria, it was legal to own a slave until 1916. Today, the descendants of slaves still face discrimination and even shaming when it comes to getting a job, getting married, or becoming a village leader. But slowly, things are starting to change. Author Adobe Trisha Wobani has been writing about the descendants of Nigeria slaves and their fight for equality.
It's clearly a taboo topic. People are ashamed of it. It's something they hide. The people I've known all my life who I know are descendants of slaves, and we've never discussed it. So you just happen to know, just the same way you know someone is Italian, someone is Russian, and you just know that this person was a descendant of a slave. It just comes up somehow, and you just don't remember how you knew, but everybody knows. But in the course of writing the story, I forced myself to talk about it with some people. And for them, it was the first time in their lives someone who wasn't a member of their families was discussing it with them. A number of people just said, no, I can't even discuss this. I can't, And then even people who agreed to speak with me, some would whisper the entire time. It may not be spoken about openly, but everybody knows who they are. It's talked about behind their backs. And people are cautioned, no, you can't marry that person. Remember, he's, a descendant of a slave. So these are things that are whispered about. And I've heard these things all my life.
As you researched your story, you interviewed a lot of slave descendants and their advocates. Introduce us, if you would, to Ogechukwu Maduagwu, and tell us about the group she founded.
Ogechukwu Maduagwu is a young woman in her 40s. In 2017, a close friend of hers was prevented from marrying a slave descendant, and she saw how devastated her friend felt, and it awakened something in her. And from then, she decided that she was going to do something to bring an end to the discrimination against slave descendants. So Oge Maduagwu founded this group that goes to different communities, engaging with the people and the traditional rulers and the descendants of slave themselves, holding reconciliation meetings with the aim of getting to a point where they abolish the discrimination, well, abolish the caste system.
She's basically a modern-day abolitionist, it sounds like.
She is a modern-day abolitionist because in all the meetings I attended, you know, I accompanied her in certain meetings around southeastern Nigeria, the word abolition was being used. So she is a modern-day abolitionist. So engaging traditional rulers, enabling meetings between the descendants of slaves, most of them bitter and aggrieved.
I'm speaking with Nigerian writer Adobe Trisha Wobani about the descendants of Nigeria's slaves and their fight for equality. Let's listen to a bit of Maduagwu and what her mission is.
Our ancestors may have spoken in darkness, but we must speak from the light. The past mistake is only a lesson and not a light into our future. So let's come together. Let's eliminate inequality and slavery that we may be truly free.
And today Maduagwu travels around Nigeria to try to convince traditional rulers to remake the rules for slave descendants. The traditional powers that be, I guess, are often baffled by her efforts to shake up the system, right?
They are baffled, but they listen to her. Some of them feel, we'll see how far we can go. Some say, yes, we're going to take definite steps. And a lot of the traditional rulers these days are well-educated. Some of them have schooled in, you know, the best schools around the world, have attended the best schools around the world. So they understand. But then without anyone having that conversation with you and pointing out how out of tune the discrimination is with today's world.
Speaking of out of tune, I mean, you describe how Maduagwu goes to a town called Ogbaru, where the descendants of slaves have had a very rough time. And the traditional leaders of the town suggest the slave descendants pay the families who once owned their ancestors $80 each to end discrimination. I mean, it's like reparations in Bizarro World. How does that idea go over?
First thing I'll say is African solutions for African problems. That's very important. This is a specific issue that has to be dealt with in a way that the people in this part of the world will understand it and accept it. They're not paying to buy their freedom. I mean, they're just saying a token amount. And the reasoning behind it is the Igbos are highly spiritual people. Africans generally believe in this.
Group of the Igbos, yeah.
Yes, the ethnic Igbo group, very spiritual people. Africans generally, spiritual people, Nigerians, very spiritual. So the people believe in a realm beyond the physical. Now, the reasoning is that money changed hands, you know, before one became a slave. And the forces that take possession of a human being and perpetrate what we now describe as oppression in today's language and in today's world hang on to that exchange, that transaction. And so if you want to send back, sort of rewind those forces, you need some transaction as well. There has to be something for them to send back those forces.
But it's just clearly like people who have to pay that money can't be happy about this.
Well, some aren't. But then they're the minority, believe it or not.
Really?
And the majority, the majority just want it to end. They want the discrimination to end. So this is strictly an African solution for an African problem. And I caution, people don't need to get outraged and begin to say, how can slaves pay for themselves? Because it's not about a payment. It's about the understanding of the people and something that will work for the culture we're dealing with. So the whole idea is you present this instrument for the reversal, which is the money, and then it's presented to the families who own the slaves, and then they strike their offer, which is their staff of authority, and declare the slaves free. So that is a completely traditional thing.
It is a fascinating look at just what slavery has been in Nigeria. What does it all mean to you today, Adobe? Because this is clearly a story that's still evolving.
I listen to the stories of the slave descendants, many of them people, you know, like me and you, people that are well-educated, people that were wealthy, people that, you know, they could have been anything in life. And then they tell you their experiences. and how their lineage, how their ancestry has been such a handicap. And it was just so painful to me to realize that something like this, the mere fact that someone's great-great-great-great-great-grandfather was owned by somebody else, has managed to hinder somebody's life, to put so many stumbling blocks in their way. That, for me, was the part that I found so horrifying, so emotional, listening to these people telling me about their experiences. And I thought, my goodness, this has to end. These are my thoughts at this time. And I'm just hoping that this story will lead to a process of deep soul searching amongst the Igbo people of southeastern Nigeria. And I hope also that it will encourage more of the slave descendants to openly declare themselves, yes, I am, yes, I was, whatever. And then, you know, bring this issue out into the light, and hopefully we can all squash it together, finally.
Writer Adobe Tricia Wobane, speaking with us from Nigeria's capital, Abuja. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Adobe's research on the descendants of slaves in Nigeria and their fight for equality was sponsored by the Pulitzer Center for Crisis Reporting. And that is The World for this Thursday, but check in with us any old time of day. We're on Twitter and on Instagram. Our handle is at PRI The World. I'm at Marco Werman. And if you don't do the social media thing, you can always find the show at theworld.org. Our theme music was composed by Ned Porter. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH right here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Hope to see you right back here tomorrow.